Okie dokie.
Today's program is brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
This is Michael Harlan Turkell, host of The Food Scene. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon and welcome. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. And may I, before I introduce my guest, remind you all that it's a pledge drive week or weeks for us. And so go to your donate button now and hit the donate button and give us some money, because where else are you going to hear programming like this? So having said that, let me introduce my guest. Her name is Sarah Teal. She founded the Adirondack Grazers in 2012. But before that, she was an award-winning documentarian, and she founded Teal Productions in 1988 after working at PBS for 6 years. She went into partnership with Sean Edwards in 2009, where she joined HBO to co-produce The Weight of the Nation. Did everybody see that? That was a fantastic series on obesity in America, which she produced with the Institute of Medicine, National Institute of Health, and the Centers for Disease Control. The series aired in the spring of 2012. And since then, she's been working on Grazers, which is the subject of our discussion today. Grazers is the story of a beef cooperative up in the Adirondacks in upstate New York. And so welcome to the program, Sarah, and tell us why, I guess, when you founded Adirondack, when you founded Adirondack Grazers, it dawned on you that perhaps you needed to have a cooperative to, make it financially viable, or how did that work out? What happened? Tell us the story.
The reason this happened is because after Weight of the Nation, I told my husband I would take a year off. And instead, we went up to our farm on the New York-Vermont border. And instead, I ended up founding a co-op because a lot of the farms around me were going out of business, especially the dairy, former dairy farms.
Right.
And it seemed to me kind of crazy that if actually they went into grass-fed beef, they could make some money. We started doing grass-fed beef on our farm because we wanted to restore some of our fields, and it's the best way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But then I realized that you cannot sell as one farm because you can't keep up a consistent supply.
Ah, yes.
So really, only as a co-op, yes, exactly. But only as a co-op can you do that, where you've got enough farms involved that you can keep supplying restaurants or butchers or whatever, consistently, every week, without letting anybody down.
Yeah.
So that's why we started it.
So
and
how many farms were involved?
Go ahead.
How many farms did you have involved when you started the co-op?
Well, in the beginning, there was just 8 to 10 farms. Mm-hmm. Now we're up to 36.
And roughly how many head of cattle does that represent?
Thousands. And in fact, I should have looked this up. But it represents, I mean, some of the farmers have herds that are around about 300-400.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them have as small as 50.
Mm-hmm.
We're the tiniest. We only have 20-something right now.
Yeah.
But it means that you can do it any size. So, we're sending 4 animals, in fact, off this week. But, some farmers get to send 15 at a time, that kind of thing. So it works out having different sizes. It doesn't matter.
Huh, interesting. And you can keep a supply going all the way through the year, which is important in terms of supply chain. So so when you started the Adirondack Grazing Cooperative, is that the right name? The Adirondack Grazing Cooperative? Yeah. You started with 8 farms, and you started it because you realized that these farms were going out of business. These had all been in the past former dairy farms. And that was what I meant by that question, by the way. Like, just backtrack a little bit about the dairy industry and why it became an obvious sort of economic decision to go from dairy farming to beef cattle.
Well,
Because I think that's an important part of this story.
Right. Well, the dairy prices go up and down, and the dairy right. prices got so low that farmers were losing money on every pint. Mm-hmm. I think my local farmer told me that it was costing him $1.65 to produce a pint of milk, and he was making a buck.
Yeah.
So with those kind of numbers, farmers are used to not making any money, which is the crazy thing. But yeah. when you're losing money that rapidly, there comes a point where it doesn't make any sense. And there has been a real consolidation in our area.
Uh-huh.
But the consolidation has meant that they are putting them in barns. So most of our farmers now, the dairy farmers, seem to house their cattle inside. A lot of them cut off their tails because once you've got them inside, only there's a lot of disease. So they cut off their tails, which has always struck me as pretty awful.
You mean disease and, because it's borne by flies?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of our farmers around me didn't want to do that either. Mm-hmm. It was kind of miserable.
Yeah.
So grass-fed beef is a lot easier. One of our farmers in our film said dairy farming's like having wives, except that there's 100 of them because you can't ever leave.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's grass-fed beef is actually much easier. And these are people who know cattle. You know, they
sure.
know the pastures, and they know their cows, and they know how to breed them and take care of them. So it actually works out very well to have former dairy farmers doing this.
You know, what's interesting to me, I'm going to jump ahead a little bit, just about sort of, because I've been conducting these interviews for close to 6 years now, so I've got a pretty good bead on, northeastern agriculture and the meat industry in general. And one of the biggest issues when grass-fed beef started to become trendy, which is about, well, maybe around 10 years ago now, it wasn't particularly easy to cook well. And
right.
I think that persists as a problem. And I know that a lot of people, wanted to buy grass-fed beef and then found that whenever they cooked it, it never turned out well. And given the premium price that one pays for it, it sort of fell into a little bit of disfavor, I think, with consumers. And then I'm hoping that genetics have caught up and people are starting to figure out how to breed yeah. a better flavor. Well, what are you using for your genetics in terms of beef cattle?
Yeah. I think there are several things that have changed, mm-hmm. actually. One is genetics, and people have discovered that only certain breeds really get big enough on grass.
Right.
And so our farmers tend to have, Devons are really good, Delta Galloway is a small but very good beef,
yeah.
Angus, we have Angus, and if they've been on grass, Angus now for several generations, they are fantastic. Herefords or Hereford Angus Cross are very good.
Huh.
But there are certain breeds that are not great. And then the other thing that has happened, now there's been generations of purely grass-fed animals, it's better. But it's baleage that has made the biggest difference.
Mm-hmm. And you should tell us what baleage is. Yeah.
Yeah. Is when you harvest your grass in the spring and the summer,
yeah.
and then you wrap it in those big white plastic things, and they look like marshmallows everywhere.
Yeah.
And then you can feed the cattle all through the winter 100% grass,
uh-huh.
and they don't lose weight. I mean, they continue to maintain and to grow, and in fact, we're finding that our grass-fed beef is now almost as big as the grain finished. So
what you mean, before you had multiple generations of grass-fed cattle, you would have maybe one generation, and then if you fed them baleage, they didn't thrive? Is that what you're saying, that they had to be fed grain in order to survive a winter?
Yeah, well, you can feed them hay, but
I see.
Hay wasn't keeping them, wasn't building their weight.
Mm-hmm.
Baleage is very, very rich. It's slightly fermented.
Ah.
It's incredibly rich, and they absolutely love it.
Yes.
And it maintains their weight in a way that normal hay just doesn't seem to.
You know, one of the things, I've done a bit of interviewing, I'm sorry to keep cutting you off like this, but this is a really
right.
interesting topic for me. And I actually spent some time this fall up in the Millerton area, and I was interviewing a few different farmers who, for various reasons, are kind of doing what you're talking about in your documentary. And they they made a big deal about the labeling issue. So I just want to like touch on that for a second, because they were I won't name names here, but they were referencing various markets that would market something as grass fed when actually it had been finished on grain, or the animal had been given grain at some point during the winter, or and this was a source of great consternation to them, and they felt that it was very unfair. And I just wanted to unravel with you a little bit of why that's even an issue. I mean, do consumers care, and why should they?
Well, we have always been made a real distinction between our beef that is 100% grass-fed. So they've been on pastures all year, and then they're finished, what they call finished, in the last month just on grass as well. And then grass-fed, so they've been on pastures all year, and grain finished. So in the last 3 or 4 months, they're fed grain.
Which,
and
by the way, is the commodity
prefer
model.
The grain because it's the animals are fatter. There's more fat. And others prefer the 100% grass. And in fact, once I've gotten used to the 100% grass and I know how to cook it now, I prefer it. But I think there ought to be a distinction, because just to call it grass-fed isn't right.
Yeah.
And there ought to be distinctions made and in labels and even on menus and that kind of thing. Because, I mean, grass is, after all, a grain. I mean, it's, grain is a grass, but it doesn't, animals don't munch it in the same way and metabolize it in the same way. Mm-hmm. So it is, and farmers that are doing 100% grass, they do take a great, and have to, great care of their pastures and what they're feeding their animals. And there is a great deal of pride, and also they're having to rotate. All of our farmers do mob grazing and rotational grazing, so they're moving their animals a lot. And I think there should be. Labeling is important, and the USDA should make a distinction, I think.
Interesting. The state at this point, and certainly the federal government, aside from saying that something is USDA, you know, organic or whatever, or they don't have a labeling mechanism for this kind of beef, do they?
No. No, there is USDA grass-fed, but it doesn't make a distinction. And these are farmers, that can just be feeding them mountains of grain. Mm-hmm. And,
And it's also...
Our farmers are small enough... and concerned enough in our area, in our state, that I don't think there's a lot of abuse of that going on, but that there will be and can be.
Well, I mean, I could hook you up with some people who would tell you very differently, Sarah, let me tell you. Oh, my God, did I get an earful. not that it wasn't fascinating. I mean, to me, it's like, you know, in a way, it's sort of... I mean, I felt it was a bit unfortunate, actually, because I think that if you're going to go with a sort of more quote-unquote natural, in the best sense, as opposed to the commercial sense, of husbandry to sort of fight over sort of labeling issues when you really want to sort of get everyone gathered under the same tent is a bit unfortunate. But I certainly understand your point, especially as it regards with regards to land stewardship and how labor intensive mob grazing and the whole sort of holistic grazing management practice is, which we will get to at a certain point. But back to your movie, because we've gone far, far astray from that. So now when you guys started aggregating your initial eight co-op members, what were the biggest challenges in creating the co-op, and then to go on from there, like how did you like find a slaughterhouse, how did you process, how did you package, how did you distribute? I mean, like, to me, these are the real issues in trying to relocalize agriculture, and so I just was hoping you would be able to, you know, take us through all that whole process, because I'm sure it was arduous.
It was pretty arduous, and I mean, the things that we got right were that we've been running the grazers as a business.
Yeah.
And so there is a board. The board meets every week on a conference call. We have regular meetings, you know, and they run everything. And now we have a full-time paid operations manager and a membership coordinator and various things.
Excellent.
So to keep it that way has worked out very well. In the beginning, it was tough because we would argue about price. We would argue about anything you can think of.
Yeah.
but that's just, you know, that's setting things up. And then we were, most of us, in Washington County. So in the beginning, we used Eagle Bridge Custom Meats, which is a sure. small and very good processor in Eagle
I'm
Bridge.
I'm familiar with them, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so we started with them, and that was great because they were small enough that they worked hard with us, and we worked hard on labeling, and we did some frozen beef in the beginning, and they worked hard on that too. And so we had a lot of support from them, and also they would tell us who were the good farmers. Oh. And you know, they see the end product, and so we right. worked with them to only be sure that we worked with the best farmers. And then since we've grown, now we use New York Custom Processing in Bridgewater, which is west of Albany, mm-hmm. and we're starting to form relationships with other slaughterhouses around the place. But we've found it best to just sort of keep it, keep those relationships close, work very closely with them.
Yeah. Well, one of the things, so, again, to go back to the conversations conversations that I had upstate was the farmers that I talked to said that they didn't have trouble finding people who would slaughter, but what they did have trouble was convincing the processors to cut to the spec that they wanted as opposed to the specs that they were used to. And I wondered if you had come to that yeah. same problem.
Yeah. Well, we started in the beginning, I thought we would have more of that problem. Mm-hmm. So in the beginning, we started with bringing a butcher up from New York to cut it. But actually, Eagle Bridge are very easy to work with. And yes, they have their preferred ways of doing things, but you can work with them and persuade them to do things otherwise. Uh-huh. So we were fine with that. Uh-huh. And we haven't had any problem. They have good cutters there. Right. We did work with one other slaughterhouse in the beginning that wasn't good. Uh-huh. And so that was horrendous.
I can imagine. Now, a lot of your beef probably winds up frozen. Am I right? How do you manage the...
No?
Oh, it all goes fresh into restaurants and farmers markets?
Well, we at one point did a lot of frozen, and it became... We found that our sweet spot is sort of in wholesale.
Great.
And selling whole animals or half animals. Because doing frozen, it meant a lot of management of tiny pieces of meat.
Yeah.
And our coordinator at the time, finally, a farmer called Lisa Randalls, who's wonderful, and she had a fit.
Yeah.
Spending her whole time running little tiny pieces of beef here, there, and everywhere.
Horrible.
And so I'm hoping that we get back to doing more of that. But for a while, we sort of stopped. Until we, and down here, there isn't much of a market for it in New York.
Uh-huh. You mean in New York
City? Because people don't have freezers at home. They don't have big freezers. You know, upstate, people will keep half a cow.
Yes.
You know, in their walk-in freezer or their freezer in the garage.
Absolutely. We did that when I was a child. Yeah.
Yeah. No, totally exactly. That's yeah. the perfect way to do it.
Yeah.
But down here, you know, people tend to buy fresh and... if they have frozen, they've got, you know, maybe a couple of steaks in the top of the fridge.
Right, right, exactly. So when you sell, you're selling wholesale, who are you, you're selling to restaurants primarily or into supermarkets or institutions? Have you tapped into the college market? Who are your buyers?
We're looking at the college market, actually. Mm-hmm. But no, we found restaurants was tough, too, because most of them haven't really got their heads around how to cook grass-fed properly,
mm-hmm.
And then also how to order. Like, we sell to Gramercy Tavern, and Michael Anthony, the chef there,
right.
spent years figuring out how to buy half a cow a week and to use every tiny bit of it.
Yes.
So he uses every bit, and they make these amazing burgers, but they also do all kinds of different things.
Oh, yeah.
With it.
We're a huge fan of Michael Anthony. We love him.
Yes, but he's kind of rare, and we're hoping to hold, in the spring, we are holding some cooking classes with different chefs to show others how to sort of get their head around how to do this.
You mean using nose to tail?
Yes, nose to tail.
Well, you really have to redesign your menu as a restaurant owner, I mean, or as a chef, right, in order to accommodate that. It's quite a tall order, I think.
It's quite a tall order. But we also sell through a group called Main Street Wholesale, and they're in Farmingdale. Mm-hmm. And they have a lot of restaurants on their books already. Mm. So they can also buy a whole animal and then get rid of all the bits and pieces.
Then they can just do the distribution part of it.
Yes. Yeah. Then it's their headache, not mine.
Yes, exactly. Well, that's what you're looking for, is somebody who is that distribution piece, because sort of harp on my vast experience here. No, but but I mean, literally in the 6 years I've been sitting in this chair, production issues and distribution issues have been the biggest impediments to growing out a regional agricultural economy. It's been a tough go for, I think, almost everybody, no matter how successful. So when you sell, so the hardest part of this process is selling all the bits and pieces. So it's really finding somebody who's willing to go that distance with you. Let me ask you, before we take a short break here, and then we're going to come back and talk more about this, but what if any, actually, let's ask, let
I,
me ask
you I this. Should also tell you that actually our biggest customer now is Fresh Direct.
Really?
And, yeah.
So and you have a big supply, girl.
Yeah, and that's been very successful, and they've been wonderful and building it up slowly with us, but we're now selling them between 10 and 15 animals a week.
Wow.
So that's a lot.
So that represents,
but they have also figured
out 2,500 pounds a week. Yeah. Or no, 25,000 pounds a week. Yeah.
It's a lot.
Yeah, that's a lot. That's a lot. I mean, that's getting up into the big boys. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, I had George Faison on from DeBraga and Spittler. You probably know George. Mm-hmm. And he was saying, well, you know, these people upstate, they're like just doing like 2 cows or 10 cows, or if nobody has more than that. And I'm like, wait a minute.
So wait a minute.
Yeah. Like, that doesn't sound quite right to me either. You know, I mean, but anyway, so tell you what, Sarah, let's stay on the line. We're going to go to a short sponsor drop and a little pitch for our pledge drive. And we'll be right back with Sarah Teal, the producer for Grazers Beef Cooperative Story. And we'll talk more about regional ag.
Since 2001, Heritage Foods USA has sold pasture-raised, antibiotic-free heritage meats to restaurants and homes around the country. Our farmers raise their animals with care using traditional methods, guaranteed to produce the very best-tasting meat. Our pork breeds include Berkshire, Redwattle, Duroc, Gloucester Old Spot, Large Black, and Tamworth, and our beef comes from Piedmontese, Angus Akiyushi, Belgian Blue, Highland, Simmental, and Belted Galloway cattle. We also carry a rotation of 24 rare breeds of heritage chicken, seasonal specialties like lamb, goat, geese, and of course, heritage turkeys. Visit us online at www.heritagefoodsusa.com or give us a call at 718-389-0985 to place your order today.
It is so exciting to have this new medium.
Hosting After the Jump has been a huge part of me transitioning from being a blogger to somebody who has sort of real important conversations with people in real life.
My show, I kind of describe it as an audio trade magazine.
I learn a ton from the guests every week, whether it's restaurants, bars.
All the hosts at Heritage all come from different perspectives.
Everyone should be listening to this. If you're interested in conservation and practical approach to renewable food sources, you know, not this big industry.
Whether it's history, laws, social policies of food, I think people now take food seriously, and hopefully what's on their plate will become something very special.
And I feel that podcasting has a future, giving people information in a format they can really use on the go.
We need your support to keep these conversations going. To donate, visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
Hit the pledge button, people. Hit the pledge button. This is Katie Kiefer at What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. We're talking today with Sarah Teal, who is the producer of Grazers, a beef cooperative story. And is that the right title? Am I saying that right, Sarah? I'm sorry if I'm garbling
well,
it. Forgive
the documentary is called Grazers, a Cooperative Story.
A Cooperative Story.
It should be
My
Grazers,
apologies.
A Cooperative Story? But
yeah. But it is, because you've just described an incredible success to me. I mean, over the course of what you made, the documentary took about 2.5 years to make, right? And over the course of however many years it's been, 3 years, you've gone from 8 farms to 35. I think that's a wild success. Extraordinary.
Yeah, it's growing, but I think the market's there. And I, of course, you guys, Heritage, have been buying from us. Emily in Essex Street Market gets a whole beef every other week from us.
Oh, is that right? Cool.
Yeah.
That's so nice to hear. I'm glad we're doing the right thing. So let's go back to, you know, talking sort of in more broad strokes. When you started the co-op, did you address or inquire about? I thought I heard in an interview something about how you got a grant to start this. And what has the state offered, or what is the state able to offer in terms of helping a regional co-op like this get its legs under it and get going? Is there any money available, any expertise? How would people?
Well, yeah, right? Not really. I mean, the Cornell Cooperative Extension has been fantastic.
Yeah.
And I guess they're partly state funded. And they've been, there's a woman called Sandy Buxton who's been really important. We also got a SARE grant, a Sustainable Agriculture Research and Education grant, which is USDA as well. And a woman called Carol Delaney there has been great. And I believe there is more USDA money coming. But that was interesting. There was a farm-to-table state meeting the other day, the first one, I suppose, of hopefully many, that the lieutenant governor was there and various people were there, and there were some very good panels. I don't know if any of you guys went, but what was interesting was there were these flat panels and people there, but no Q&A. They didn't want to hear anything from the people in the audience.
Really?
No feedback. Yeah, it was very strange. And so there's, you know, Twitter's been helpful. We were friended by Senator Gillibrand's office, and they've been reaching out to us for more information. So I think there is, we sold $1 million, close to $1 million in grass-fed beef this year.
Wow.
And that's going pretty much directly to farmers.
Fantastic.
There's a small percentage that goes to the co-op to help run it.
Yeah, of course.
So I think there is an understanding now from the governor and from the New York City mayor that there is potential for bringing money to upstate New York where they seriously need it, and to farmers.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there is a willingness to try and help. I just don't think they know how. And yes, it would be very helpful to get funding. I was at something that the Modern Farmer magazine held recently about
lab beef.
That magazine.
Yeah.
So it was about lab beef, and the guy that was started this company to make cultured meat, you know, meat in the laboratory, essentially.
Yeah, petri dish meat.
He got $11 million in funding in the first sort of week of having done more or less nothing. And it just made me so wild, you know? Here we are doing something that is bringing money to farmers and for a really good product that people want.
Right. And in addition, represents environmental stewardship of the first order, which I think, you know, we all can appreciate that aspect of it, even if we don't think of it as first thing. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. And it's, and yet there's no interest in supporting that kind of thing. I mean, we're kind of proud that we're running it as a business and that we don't need that much help. We did get a grant from New York Farm Viability for $75,000, which was incredibly helpful.
Mm-hmm.
But it would be nice to have some more state support. It definitely would. I mean, we've got one membership coordinator running around out there signing up more farms, because we now need more farms. We've got enough sales.
Because your demand is high enough.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's what we were going to, I'm so glad you brought that up, because that was something I did want to address with you, because a few weeks ago I had Mel Coleman on from Nyman Ranch, and we were talking about, and this goes back to this Chef's Collaborative, and the whole theme of Chef's Collaborative this year is about scaling up and how to make that work without depressing prices, without, you know, finding other ways of sort of basically shooting yourself in the foot, while at the same time guaranteeing your farmers, you know, a fair price for their product. And so you're saying that you have enough demand now that you need more people to be following. Oh, how do you certify your farmers? Just out of curiosity, how do you know that you find a farmer you want to work with?
We have very good, we have strict protocols, but we have two people now running who just, I mean, we know our farmers very well. We've always visited them. And then now we make sure that we visit them at least once or twice a year. And one of our farmers is in charge of that now. And she's great. But it's amazing how people will actually police each other. Because there are a lot of people in the co-op who are very proud of how they're doing raising grass-fed beef.
Sure.
And they don't want to dilute that that brand and that whatever. So we aren't, I hope, letting in people who will do that. I mean, we're keeping it pretty pretty strict on the protocols and making sure that we're keeping an eye on people. And it, but we also do rely on the slaughterhouse for them saying to us, you know, hey, that last one wasn't great. Or from Fresh Direct. I mean, there's been a lot of feedback. Emily from Heritage gave us a lot of feedback in the beginning. And then Fresh Direct now, it's more like a partnership in the sense that they give us a lot of feedback on who's good and who's not so good and how to improve things. And so it becomes it does become a conversation and a partnership to keep the standards up.
Right. Well, that sounds fantastic. It's great that you have, it's still small enough scale that you have that kind of direct interface with your participants so that you can, you know, continue to sort of not just monitor, but also advise and help people who might be struggling perhaps with some of the protocols. You know, one of the things that I think is so interesting, and no one has ever been able to answer this properly, and in a way it's sort of a hyperbolic question, I suppose, but why is there no venture capital investing in regional agriculture? What do you think the answer is to that?
I don't know.
I mean, isn't that weird? It's so trendy. You'd think people would be falling over themselves to set up, you know, production and aggregation warehouses or facilities or distribution networks or buy a fleet of trucks or something. But nothing like that is happening, and I don't get that.
I know. I don't get that either. And especially with the trucking, I think the trucking's coming because there's such an opportunity there for people to set up proper trucking. I mean, we were distributed by Regional Access, and they just dropped picking anything up from Eagle Bridge one day, and that left us completely stranded, us and lots of other people.
And what did you do? How did you solve that? Did you have to rent a truck or buy a truck or rely on the farmers?
No, none of us wanted to do that because it's not easy. But Mark Jaffe from Fresh Connect, came in and has been doing it. And it, you know, I think he's going to be growing his company, but it's definitely a gap.
Yeah, it's a huge gap. And it's the same gap that existed, you know, when I started doing this program. And that's the thing that I, you know, given the escalation of interest in food and the, you know, the overwhelming changes in our, you know, just basic knowledge about where our food comes from and why we want to eat the way we eat or whatever, you know, it's like there is so much media around this, and yet somehow money has lagged far behind. And I just find that such a conundrum. I really cannot think of what the reason is behind it. Let's talk a little bit about, because we only have a few minutes left, let's talk a little bit about how farms are disappearing. I mean, one of the more touching elements of your film, I thought, was, you know, some of the farmers were saying, well, this has been in my family for generations, and, you know, you know, we were dying as a dairy farm. We reinvented ourselves, and you know, I want the farm to stay alive until the kids come. But what about people who are younger and who want to get into farming? You know, the land values have increased so much, especially in upstate New York. What is the solution there? Is there, do you find more land leasing and land borrowing, and, you know, from rich people who have bought old farms?
Yeah.
There's a lot of that, right?
A lot of our farmers, in the film, there's a one farmer, Steve Reed, and he leases most of his land.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we always lease to our local farmer. It's not that any much money is changing hands.
Right.
But it allows whoever owns that land to get an ag exemption.
Right.
And then you see your land actually work, which is the main thing.
Right, and somebody's taking care of it. Yeah.
Yeah, and somebody's taking care of it. So there are opportunities for leasing. There are groups like our sponsor on the film was the Agricultural Stewardship Association in Greenwich, New York, and they're doing an awful lot to preserve farmland, but then also to help starter farmers, you know, young farmers that want to come in.
Yeah.
And I think the co-op is helpful for that kind of thing, too, because so often now those young people are starting, but they don't have the market and they don't have the marketing ability and to really get going. And this gives them a sort of guaranteed market without much effort. You know, we take on all the marketing and the sales.
Right.
So it's helpful for new young farmers, too. But it's definitely not easy to get in and to make money. I mean, there are people doing it, but it's hard work, and the income isn't there. And then once you start a family, you're really screwed.
Oh,
I don't know how they're going to do it.
Well, you know, I
can definitely help.
I went to Australia this summer and on a cattle tour with the Meat and Livestock Association of Australia, which was a fascinating experience, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
For a meat geek like me, you don't realize, Sarah, what a meat geek I am, but I am. And there were farms, and in Australia, obviously, the farms are vast. I mean, 70,000 acres, not unusual, okay? And
wow.
These people are driving their kids 3 hours each way to go to school until that just becomes not possible. But it was just fast. I mean, like the sacrifices they make to stay on the farm and to keep their kids within the mainstream, but at the same time, grow those kids up to be stewards of the land and be on the farm. It was fascinating. Anyway, enough about me. I love talking about myself when I'm interviewing someone else. That's what makes me such a great interviewer.
But I think that's what we've got to do. I mean, the film points out, you know, New York State's losing a farm every 3 days.
Yes, I heard that.
And if we can't keep those, I just want those farms to stay in farm families, because farm families know what they're doing. I mean, they've been working that land, as you said, some of them for generations.
That's right.
And they know what they're doing.
Yeah.
And we're losing that knowledge base.
Yes.
You know, it's an old story, but it is. I don't think people realize how rapidly it's happening and still happening.
Well, I think it's, it's back to almost the dairy story, where you talked about the consolidation of the dairy industry and how the prices became depressed. And certainly the consolidation of the cattle industry is, you know, the stuff of nightmares. I mean, it's like why we eat the way we eat now is because of the consolidation and contraction of the meat industry as a whole into, four or five main companies. So, at the very least, we want to establish a beachhead and hold on to it for dear life of people who still know how to just raise cattle the way they've done it for generations. Now, and that leads me to my next question, which is how the hell did you learn how to do it? I mean, you went up, you took a year off from producing, you know, award-winning documentary films for HBO, and the next thing you know, you're starting a grazing beef cooperative. It's like, wait a minute. Wait, you know, I'm missing a piece of the puzzle
insane.
Here. I think it's a really cool story.
I grew up with it. I did grow up with it. My dad is a large animal vet, and I grew up in a little village with farmers and around farmers.
His name isn't James Harriet, is it? No.
Yeah, I think there must be something genetic about.
I mean, my favorite book was those James Harriet books of being a large animal vet.
Exactly,
he was
like Siegfried in those books.
Yeah,
and my dad would used to sing opera to cows because he thought they liked it, and which they do.
I've heard that.
So I grew up with it, but we then started having our own grass-fed beef in 2011. And even though we only have a tiny, we buy little ones from co-op members and then grow them up on the land.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been very useful because then I can see I understand all the good things and all the challenges because we've got them right in our garden.
Yeah, exactly. So, and do you have kids who help
right
you?
There.
I hope you have a pack of children who are mucking out the stalls and carrying the water.
Well, the daughter was only six, and so, you know, she's grown up with them. She's grown up with them, too, and she's the little one in the film that's out there with the cows and perfectly happy to sit amongst them and read her books and things.
I saw... yes, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, it's just been nice actually having them around.
Oh no, I think cattle are divine myself. I really love cows.
Me too.
I think they're heaven.
Me
and,
too.
And I should send you the link to this video that I saw on Facebook of a little girl who was a little bit younger than your daughter who had let a young heifer into sort of the breezeway of her home, family home, and the cow was lying down on the floor with the dog and the little girl, and the mom comes in and she's like, "Why is the cow in the house?" And the little girl is like this funny little story. And then she lies down with the kid lies down with the cow and pulls the cow's head into her lap. And the cow stays there. And the woman says, "I don't think I can ever eat beef again."
I know. Well, this is
I don't know how you do that. Yeah. It is a problem.
We had a photograph of Rosie, our daughter, with the cows when she was quite little. She must have been like 3 or 4.
Uh-huh.
And but she has no trousers, she's no pants on. And she's standing with them all right round her. And we had people were like, "You should maybe take that off your website."
Yeah, I guess some people might get that. People with the wrong kind of thinking in general would not appreciate it.
Yeah,
right? Exactly. Well, Sarah, I'm sorry to say we must wrap this up. Please let us promote your film and tell us when any other screenings I hope will be happening soon.
Thank you. Yes, funny, it's been so weird because it was in Doc NYC.
Yep.
And now we're getting a lot of interest from PBS and distributors, so it's going to have a life.
I'm so glad to hear that because I wish you the best. I think it's a great project. And when we're not on the air, we will discuss a little project of mine that is quite complimentary to that, if you don't mind. And
sure.
So people can go to your website, which is?
For the Grazers documentary or the Grazers?
Yes.
The Adirondack Grazers is www.adkgrazers.com. It's for the Adirondack Grazers. And then if you just type in Grazers documentary in Google, they'll come up a website for that too.
Right. And you'll have show times as they evolve and people can watch a trailer and learn a little bit more about the film and the families and how
and we're using the film as an education tool too. We're doing a how-to booklet and sending it out to anyone who requests it.
Fantastic.
To do screenings in the farm community. So
awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining me today, and I'm sorry I was so interrupting.
It was lovely. Thank you.
Sometimes I'm better about that than others. Today, I don't know, a little hyper. What can I tell you? Too much coffee. But I see you have an office in Union Square, so one of these days I'll be knocking on your door to say hi.
Great. Wonderful.
All right. Thank you. Okay. Thank you again. And thank you
to
my sponsor.
So
you're most welcome. Thank you to Heritage Foods for my sponsorship. Remember, folks, it's our pledge drive. Please go to the website. Hit the donate button. It's not a lot of money, and it really makes a difference to the operation of the station. And, you know, we want to keep growing. We want to keep bringing great guests like Sarah Teal and all of the other wonderful guests I've had on my show and all the other hosts who just mine the media for great guests and great ideas. And it's just you can't hear it anywhere else. So please drop some money into the pot. Feel good about yourself. And remember, it's tax deductible. Thanks a lot for listening. We'll see you next week. So long now.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.